Kapital, in the Neue Rheinische Zeitung, number 266, 7th of April, 1849. The articles published under this title in the Neue Rheinische Zeitung are parts of some lectures given by me on that subject in 1847 in the German Arbeiterverein at Brussels, the publication of which was interrupted by the Revolution of February. End of footnote. Chapter 24. Conversion of Surplus Value into Capital. Section 1. Capitalist Production on a Progressively Increasing Scale. Transition of the laws of property that characterize production of commodities into laws of capitalist appropriation. Hitherto, we have investigated how surplus value emanates from capital. We have now to see how capital arises from surplus value. Employing surplus value as capital, reconverting it into capital, is called accumulation of capital. Footnote. Accumulation of capital. The employment of a portion of revenue as capital. Malthus, Definitions, etc., edited Kazanov. Conversion of revenue into capital. Malthus, Principles of Political Economy, 1836. End of footnote. First, let us consider this transaction from the standpoint of the individual capitalist. Suppose a spinner to have advanced a capital of £10,000, of which four-fifths, £8,000, are laid out in cotton, machinery, etc., and one-fifth, £2,000, in wages. Let him produce £240,000 of yarn annually, having a value of £2,000. The rate of surplus value being 100%, the surplus value lies in the surplus or net product of £40,000 of yarn, one-sixth of the gross product, with a value of £2,000, which will be realized by a sale. £2,000 is £2,000. We can neither see nor smell in this sum of money a trace of surplus value. When we know that a given value is surplus value, we know how its owner came by it. But that does not alter the nature either of value or of money. In order to convert this additional sum of £2,000 into capital, the master spinner will, all circumstances remaining as before, advance four-fifths of it, £1,600, in the purchase of cotton, etc., and one-fifth, £400, in the purchase of additional spinners, who will find in the market the necessaries of life whose value the master has advanced to them. Then the new capital of £2,000 functions in the spinning mill, and brings in its turn, a surplus value of £400. The capital value was originally advanced in the money form. The surplus value, on the contrary, is originally the value of a definite portion of the gross product. If this gross product be sold, converted into money, the capital value regains its original form. From this moment, the capital value and the surplus value are both of them sums of money, and their reconversion into capital takes place in precisely the same way. The one, as well as the other, is laid out by the capitalist in the purchase of commodities that place him in a position to begin afresh the fabrication of his goods, and this time on an extended scale. But in order to be able to buy those commodities, he must find them ready in the market. His own yarns circulate only because he brings his annual product to market, as all other capitalists likewise do with their commodities. But these commodities, before coming to market, were part of the general annual product, part of the total mass of objects of every kind, into which the sum of the individual capitals, that is, the total capital of society, had been converted in the course of the year, and of which each capitalist had in hand only an aliquot part. The transactions in the market effectuate only the interchange of the individual components of this annual product, transfer them from one hand to another, but can neither augment the total annual production nor alter the nature of the objects produced. Hence, the use that can be made of the total annual product depends entirely upon its own composition, but in no way upon circulation. The annual production must in the first place furnish all those objects, use values, from which the material components of capital, used up in the course of the year, have to be replaced. Deducting these, there remains the net or surplus product, in which the surplus value lies. And of what does this surplus product consist? Only of things destined to satisfy the wants and desires of the capitalist class, things which consequently enter into the consumption fund of the capitalists? Were that the case, the cup of surplus value would be drained to the very dregs, and nothing but simple reproduction would ever take place. To accumulate, it is necessary to convert a portion of the surplus product into capital. But we cannot, except by a miracle, convert into capital anything but such articles as can be employed in the labour process, that is, means of production, and such further articles as are suitable for the sustenance of the labourer, that is, means of subsistence. Consequently, a part of the annual surplus labour must have been applied to the production of additional means of production and subsistence, over and above the quantity of these things required to replace the capital advanced. In one word, surplus value is convertible into capital solely because the surplus product, whose value it is, already comprises the material elements of new capital. Footnote. We here take no account of export trade, by means of which a nation can change articles of luxury either into means of production or means of subsistence, and vice versa. In order to examine the object of our investigation in its integrity, free from all disturbing subsidiary circumstances, we must treat the whole world as one nation, and assume that capitalist production is everywhere established and has possessed itself of every branch of industry. End of footnote. Now, in order to allow of these elements actually functioning as capital, the capitalist class requires additional labour. If the exploitation of the labourers already employed do not increase, either extensively or intensively, then additional labour power must be found. For this, the mechanism of capitalist production provides beforehand, by converting the working class into a class dependent on wages, a class whose ordinary wages suffice not only for its maintenance, but for its increase. It is only necessary for capital to incorporate this additional labour power, annually supplied by the working class in the shape of labourers of all ages, with the surplus means of production comprised in the annual produce, and the conversion of surplus value into capital is complete. From a concrete point of view, accumulation resolves itself into the reproduction of capital on a progressively increasing scale. The circle in which simple reproduction moves alters its form, and to use Sismondi's expression, changes into a spiral. Footnote. Sismondi's analysis of accumulation suffers from the great defect that he contents himself to too great an extent with the phrase conversion of revenue into capital, without fathoming the material conditions of this operation. End of footnote. Let us now return to our illustration. It is the old story. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob, and so on. The original capital of £10,000 brings in a surplus value of £2,000, which is capitalized. The new capital of £2,000 brings in a surplus value of £400, and this too is capitalized, converted into a second additional capital, which, in its turn, produces a further surplus value of £80, and so the ball rolls on. We here leave out of consideration the portion of the surplus value consumed by the capitalist. Just as little does it concern us, for the moment, whether the additional capital is joined on to the original capital or is separated from it to function independently, whether the same capitalist who accumulated it employs it, or whether he hands it over to another. This only we must not forget, that by the side of the newly formed capital, the original capital continues to reproduce itself and to produce surplus value, and that this is also true of all accumulated capital and the additional capital engendered by it. The original capital was formed by the advance of £10,000. How did the owner become possessed of it? By his own labour and that of his forefathers, answer unanimously the spokesmen of political economy. Footnote: the original labour to which his capital owed its origin. Sismondi. End of footnote. And, in fact, their supposition appears the only one consonant with the laws of the production of commodities. But it is quite otherwise with regard to the additional capital of £2,000. How that originated, we know perfectly well. There is not one single atom of its value that does not owe its existence to unpaid labour. The means of production, with which the additional labour power is incorporated, as well as the necessaries with which the labourers are sustained, are nothing but component parts of the surplus product, of the tribute annually extracted from the working class by the capitalist class. Though the latter, with a portion of that tribute, purchases the additional labour power even at its full price, so that equivalent is exchanged for equivalent, yet the transaction is, for all that, only the old dodge of every conqueror who buys commodities from the conquered with the money he has robbed them of. If the additional capital employs the person who produced it, this producer must not only continue to augment the value of the original capital, but must buy back the fruits of his previous labour with more labour than they cost. When viewed as a transaction between the capitalist class and the working class, it makes no difference that additional labourers are employed by means of the unpaid labour of the previously employed labourers. The capitalist may even convert the additional capital into a machine that throws the producers of that capital out of work and that replaces them by a few children. In every case, the working class creates, by the surplus labour of 1 year, the capital destined to employ additional labour in the following year. And this is what is called creating capital out of capital. Footnote: labour creates capital before capital employs labour. E.G. Wakefield, England and America, 1833. End of footnote. The accumulation of the first additional capital of £2,000 presupposes a value of £10,000 belonging to the capitalist by virtue of his primitive labour and advanced by him. The second additional capital of £400 presupposes, on the contrary, only the previous accumulation of the £2,000, of which the £400 is the surplus value capitalised. The ownership of past unpaid labour is thenceforth the sole condition for the appropriation of living unpaid labour on a constantly increasing scale. The more the capitalist has accumulated, the more he is able to accumulate. Insofar as the surplus value, of which the additional capital, number one, consists, is the result of the purchase of labour power with part of the original capital, a purchase that conformed to the laws of the exchange of commodities, and that, from a legal standpoint, presupposes nothing beyond the free disposal, on the part of the labourer, of his own capacities, and on the part of the owner, of money or commodities, of the values that belong to him, in so far as the additional capital, number two, etc., is the mere result of number one, and therefore a consequence of the above conditions, in so far as each single transaction invariably conforms to the laws of the exchange of commodities, the capitalist buying labour power, the labourer selling it, and we will assume at its real value? Insofar as all this is true, it is evident that the laws of appropriation or of private property, laws that are based on the production and circulation of commodities, become by their own inner and inexorable dialectic changed into their very opposite. The exchange of equivalents, the original operation with which we started, has now become turned around in such a way that there is only an apparent exchange. This is owing to the fact, first, that the capital which is exchanged for labour power is itself but a portion of the product of others' labour appropriated without an equivalent, and secondly, that this capital must not only be replaced by its producer, but replaced together with an added surplus. The relation of exchange subsisting between capitalist and labourer becomes a mere semblance appertaining to the process of circulation, a mere form, foreign to the real nature of the transaction, and only mystifying it. The ever-repeated purchase and sale of labour power is now the mere form. What really takes place is this. The capitalist again and again appropriates, without equivalent, a portion of the previously materialised labour of others, and exchanges it for a greater quantity of living labour. At first, the rights of property seemed to us to be based on a man's own labour. At least, some such assumption was necessary, since only commodity owners with equal rights confronted each other, and the sole means by which a man could become possessed of the commodities of others was by alienating his own commodities, and these could be replaced by labour alone. Now, however, property turns out to be the right, on the part of the capitalist, to appropriate the unpaid labour of others, or its product, and to be the impossibility, on the part of the labourer, of appropriating his own product. The separation of property from labour has become the necessary consequence of a law that apparently originated in their identity. Footnote. The property of the capitalist in the product of the labour of others is a strict consequence of the law of appropriation, the fundamental principle of which was, on the contrary, the exclusive title of every labourer to the product of his own labour. Cherbuliez, Richesse ou Pauvreté, Paris, 1841, where, however, the dialectical reversal is not properly developed. End of footnote. Therefore, however much the capitalist mode of appropriation may seem to fly in the face of the original laws of commodity production, it nevertheless arises not from a violation, but on the contrary, from the application of these laws. Let us make this clear once more by briefly reviewing the consecutive phases of motion, whose culminating point is capitalist accumulation. We saw, in the first place, that the original conversion of a sum of values into capital was achieved in complete accordance with the laws of exchange. One party to the contract sells his labour power, the other buys it. The former receives the value of his commodity, whose use value, labour, is thereby alienated to the buyer. Means of production, which already belong to the latter, are then transformed by him, with the aid of labour equally belonging to him, into a new product which is likewise lawfully his. The value of this product includes, first, the value of the used-up means of production. Useful labour cannot consume these means of production without transferring their value to the new product, but to be saleable, labour power must be capable of supplying useful labour in the branch of industry in which it is to be employed. The value of the new product further includes the equivalent of the value of the labour power together with the surplus value. This is so because the value of the labour power, sold for a definite length of time, say a day, a week, etc., is less than the value created by its use during that time. But the worker has received payment for the exchange value of his labour power, and by so doing has alienated its use value, this being the case in every sale and purchase. The fact that this particular commodity, labour power, possesses the peculiar use value of supplying labour and therefore of creating value cannot affect the general law of commodity production. If, therefore, the magnitude of value advanced in wages is not merely found again in the product, but is found there augmented by a surplus value, this is not because the seller has been defrauded, for he has really received the value of his commodity. It is due solely to the fact that this commodity has been used up by the buyer. The law of exchange requires equality only between the exchange values of the commodities given in exchange for one another. From the very outset, it presupposes even a difference between their use values, and it has nothing whatever to do with their consumption, which only begins after the deal is closed and executed. Thus, the original conversion of money into capital is achieved in the most exact accordance with the economic laws of commodity production and with the right of property derived from them. Nevertheless, its result is 1. That the product belongs to the capitalist and not to the worker. 2. That the value of this product includes, besides the value of the capital advanced, a surplus value which costs the worker labour, but the capitalist nothing, and which nonetheless becomes the legitimate property of the capitalist. 3. That the worker has retained his labour power and can sell it anew, if he can find a buyer. Simple reproduction is only the periodical repetition of this first operation. Each time, money is converted afresh into capital. Thus, the law is not broken. On the contrary, it is merely enabled to operate continuously. Several successive acts of exchange have only made the last represent the first. Sismondi, Nouveau Principe, etc. And yet we have seen that simple reproduction suffices to stamp this first operation, insofar as it is conceived as an isolated process, with a totally changed character. Of those who share the national income among themselves, the one side, the workers, acquire every year a fresh right to their share by fresh work. The others, the capitalists, have already acquired, by work done originally, a permanent right to their share. Sismondi. It is indeed notorious that the sphere of labour is not the only one in which primogeniture works miracles. Nor does it matter if simple reproduction is replaced by reproduction on an extended scale by accumulation. In the former case, the capitalist squanders the whole surplus value in dissipation. In the latter, he demonstrates his bourgeois virtue by consuming only a portion of it and converting the rest into money. The surplus value is his property. It has never belonged to anyone else. If he advances it for the purposes of production, the advances made come from his own funds, exactly as on the day when he first entered the market. The fact that on this occasion the funds are derived from the unpaid labour of his workers makes absolutely no difference. If worker B is paid out of the surplus value which worker A produced, then, in the first place, A furnished that surplus value without having the just price of his commodity cut by a halfpenny. And in the second place, the transaction is no concern of B's whatever. What B claims, and has a right to claim, is that the capitalist should pay him the value of his labour power. Quote, both were still gainers. The worker, because he was advanced the fruits of his labour, should read, of the unpaid labour of other workers, before the work was done, should read, before his own labour had borne fruit. The employer, le maître, because the labour of this worker was worth more than his wages, should read, produced more value than the value of his wages. Unquote, Sismondi. To be sure, the matter looks quite different if we consider capitalist production in the uninterrupted flow of its renewal, and if, in place of the individual capitalist and the individual worker, we view in their totality the capitalist class and the working class confronting each other. But in so doing, we should be applying standards entirely foreign to commodity production. Only buyer and seller, mutually independent, face each other in commodity production. The relations between them cease on the day when the term stipulated in the contract they concluded expires. If the transaction is repeated, it is repeated as the result of a new agreement which has nothing to do with the previous one, and which only by chance brings the same seller together again with the same buyer. If, therefore, commodity production, or one of its associated processes, is to be judged according to its own economic laws, we must consider each act of exchange by itself, apart from any connection with the act of exchange preceding it and that following it. And since sales and purchases are negotiated solely between particular individuals, it is not admissible to seek here for relations between whole social classes. However long a series of periodical reproductions and preceding accumulations the capital functioning today may have passed through, it always preserves its original virginity. So long as the laws of exchange are observed in every single act of exchange, the mode of appropriation can be completely revolutionized without in any way affecting the property rights which correspond to commodity production. These same rights remain in force both at the outset, when the product belongs to its producer, who, exchanging equivalent for equivalent, can enrich himself only by his own labour, and also in the period of capitalism, when social wealth becomes, to an ever-increasing degree, the property of those who are in a position to appropriate continually and ever afresh the unpaid labour of others. This result becomes inevitable from the moment there is a free sale, by the labourer himself, of labour power as a commodity. But it is also only from then onwards that commodity production is generalised and becomes the typical form of production. It is only from then onwards that, from the first, every product is produced for sale, and all wealth produced goes through the sphere of circulation. Only when and where wage labour is its basis does commodity production impose itself upon society as a whole, but only then and there also does it unfold all its hidden potentialities. To say that the supervention of wage labour adulterates commodity production is to say that commodity production must not develop if it is to remain unadulterated. To the extent that commodity production, in accordance with its own inherent laws, develops further into capitalist production, the property laws of commodity production change into the laws of capitalist appropriation. Footnote. We may well, therefore, feel astonished at the cleverness of Proudhon, who would abolish capitalistic property by enforcing the eternal laws of property that are based on commodity production. End of footnote. We have seen that even in the case of simple reproduction, all capital, whatever its original source, becomes converted into accumulated capital, capitalized surplus value. But in the flood of production, all the capital originally advanced becomes a vanishing quantity, magnitudo evanescens, in the mathematical sense, compared with the directly accumulated capital, that is, with the surplus value or surplus product that is reconverted into capital, whether it functions in the hands of its accumulator or in those of others. Hence, political economy describes capital in general as accumulated wealth, converted surplus value or revenue, that is employed over again in the production of surplus value, footnote, Capital, viz., accumulated wealth employed with a view to profit, Malthus. Capital, consists of wealth saved from revenue and used with a view to profit, R. Jones. An introductory lecture on political economy, 1833, end of footnote. And the capitalist as the owner of surplus value. Footnote. The possessors of surplus produce or capital. The source and remedy of the national difficulties. A letter to Lord John Russell, 1821, end of footnote. It is merely another way of expressing the same thing, to say that all existing capital is accumulated or capitalized interest. For interest is a mere fragment of surplus value. Footnote. Capital, with compound interest on every portion of capital saved, is so all-engrossing that all the wealth in the world from which income is derived has long ago become the interest on capital. London, Economist, 19th of July, 1851. End of footnote. Section 2. Erroneous conception, by political economy, of reproduction on a progressively increasing scale. Before we further investigate accumulation or the reconversion of surplus value into capital, we must brush on one side an ambiguity introduced by the classical economists. Just as little as the commodities that the capitalist buys with a part of the surplus value for his own consumption serve the purpose of production and of creation of value, so little is the labour that he buys for the satisfaction of his natural and social requirements, productive labour. Instead of converting surplus value into capital, he, on the contrary, by the purchase of those commodities and that labour, consumes or expends it as revenue. In the face of the habitual mode of life of the old feudal nobility, which, as Hegel rightly says, consists in consuming what is in hand, and more especially displays itself in the luxury of personal retainers, it was extremely important for bourgeois economy to promulgate the doctrine that accumulation of capital is the first duty of every citizen, and to preach without ceasing that a man cannot accumulate if he eats up all his revenue, instead of spending a good part of it in the acquisition of additional productive labourers who bring in more than they cost. On the other hand, the economists had to contend against the popular prejudice that confuses capitalist production with hoarding, and fancies that accumulated wealth is either wealth that is rescued from being destroyed in its existing form, that is, from being consumed, or wealth that is withdrawn from circulation. Footnote. No political economist of the present day can, by saving, mean mere hoarding. And beyond this contracted and insufficient proceeding, no use of the term in reference to the national wealth can well be imagined, but that which must arise from a different application of what is saved, founded upon a real distinction between the different kinds of labour maintained by it. Malthus, end of footnote. Exclusion of money from circulation would also exclude absolutely its self-expansion as capital, while accumulation of a hoard in the shape of commodities would be sheer tomfoolery. Footnote. Thus, for instance, Balzac, who so thoroughly studied every shade of avarice, represents the old usurer Gobseck as in his second childhood when he begins to heap up a hoard of commodities. End of footnote. The accumulation of commodities in great masses is the result either of overproduction or of a stoppage of circulation. Footnote. Accumulation of stocks, non-exchange, overproduction. Thomas Corbett. It is true that the popular mind is impressed by the sight, on the one hand, of the mass of goods that are stored up for gradual consumption by the rich. Footnote. In this sense, Necker speaks of the things of pomp and luxury of which accumulation has grown with time, and which the laws of property have brought into the hands of one class of society alone. Œuvre de M. Necker, Paris and Lausanne, 1789. End of footnote. And on the other hand, by the formation of reserve stocks. The latter, a phenomenon that is common to all modes of production, and on which we shall dwell for a moment when we come to analyze circulation. Classical economy is therefore quite right when it maintains that the consumption of surplus products by productive instead of by unproductive laborers is a characteristic feature of the process of accumulation. But at this point, the mistakes also begin. Adam Smith has made it the fashion to represent accumulation as nothing more than consumption of surplus products by productive laborers, which amounts to saying that the capitalizing of surplus value consists in merely turning surplus value into labor power. Let us see what Ricardo, for example, says. It must be understood that all the productions of a country are consumed, but it makes the greatest difference imaginable whether they are consumed by those who reproduce or by those who do not reproduce another value. When we say that revenue is saved and added to capital, what we mean is that the portion of revenue so said to be added to capital is consumed by productive instead of unproductive laborers. There can be no greater error than in supposing that capital is increased by non-consumption. There can be no greater error than that which Ricardo and all subsequent economists repeat after A. Smith, viz., that the part of revenue of which it is said it has been added to capital is consumed by productive laborers. According to this, all surplus value that is changed into capital becomes variable capital. So far from this being the case, the surplus value, like the original capital, divides itself into constant capital and variable capital, into means of production and labor power. Labor power is the form under which variable capital exists during the process of production. In this process, the labor power is itself consumed by the capitalist, while the means of production are consumed by the labor power in the exercise of its function, labor. At the same time, the money paid for the purchase of the labor power is converted into necessaries that are consumed not by productive labor, but by the productive laborer. Adam Smith, by a fundamentally perverted analysis, arrives at the absurd conclusion that even though each individual capital is divided into a constant and a variable part, the capital of society resolves itself only into variable capital, that is laid out exclusively in payment of wages. For instance, suppose a cloth manufacturer converts £2,000 into capital. One portion he lays out in buying weavers, the other in woolen yarn, machinery, etc. But the people, from whom he buys the yarn and the machinery, pay for labour with a part of the purchase money, and so on, until the whole £2,000 are spent in the payment of wages, that is, until the entire product represented by the £2,000 has been consumed by productive labourers. It is evident that the whole gist of this argument lies in the words, and so on, which send us from pillar to post. In truth, Adam Smith breaks his investigation off just where its difficulties begin. Footnote. In spite of his logic, John Stuart Mill never detects even such faulty analysis as this when made by his predecessors, an analysis which, even from the bourgeois standpoint of the science, cries out for rectification. In every case, he registers with the dogmatism of a disciple the confusion of his master's thoughts. So here, the capital itself in the long run becomes entirely wages, and when replaced by the sale of produce, becomes wages again. End of footnote. The annual process of reproduction is easily understood so long as we keep in view merely the sum total of the year's production. But every single component of this product must be brought into the market as a commodity, and there the difficulty begins. The movements of the individual capitals and of the personal revenues cross and intermingle, and are lost in the general change of places, in the circulation of the wealth of society. This dazes the sight, and propounds very complicated problems for solution. In the third part of Book Two, I shall give the analysis of the real bearings of the facts. It is one of the great merits of the physiocrats that in their tableau économique, they were the first to attempt to depict the annual production in the shape in which it is presented to us after passing through the process of circulation. Footnote. In his description of the process of reproduction and of accumulation, Adam Smith, in many ways, not only made no advance, but even lost considerable ground compared with his predecessors, especially by the physiocrats. Connected with the illusion mentioned in the text is the really wonderful dogma, left by him as an inheritance to political economy, the dogma that the price of commodities is made up of wages, profit, interest, and rent, that is, of wages and surplus value. Starting from this basis, Storch naively confesses, it is impossible to resolve the necessary price into its simplest elements. Storch, 1815. A fine science of economy this, which declares it impossible to resolve the price of a commodity into its simplest elements. This point will be further investigated in the seventh part of Book Three. End of footnote. For the rest, it is a matter of course that political economy, acting in the interests of the capitalist class, has not failed to exploit the doctrine of Adam Smith, viz., that the whole of that part of the surplus product which is converted into capital is consumed by the working class. Section 3. Separation of surplus value into capital and revenue. The abstinence theory. In the last preceding chapter, we treated surplus value, or the surplus product, solely as a fund for supplying the individual consumption of the capitalist. In this chapter we have, so far, treated it solely as a fund for accumulation. It is, however, neither the one nor the other, but is both together. One portion is consumed by the capitalist as revenue, the other is employed as capital, is accumulated. Footnote. The reader will notice that the word revenue is used in a double sense. First, to designate surplus value so far as it is the fruit periodically yielded by capital. Secondly, to designate the part of that fruit which is periodically consumed by the capitalist, or added to the fund that supplies his private consumption. I have retained this double meaning because it harmonizes with the language of the English and French economists. End of footnote. Given the mass of surplus value, then, the larger the one of these parts, the smaller is the other. Ceteris paribus, the ratio of these parts determines the magnitude of the accumulation. But it is by the owner of the surplus value, by the capitalist alone, that the division is made. It is his deliberate act. That part of the tribute exacted by him which he accumulates is said to be saved by him, because he does not eat it. That is, because he performs the function of a capitalist, and enriches himself. Except as personified capital, the capitalist has no historical value and no right to that historical existence which, to use an expression of the witty Lichnowsky, hasn't got no date. And so far, only is the necessity for his own transitory existence implied in the transitory necessity for the capitalist mode of production. But, so far as he has personified capital, it is not values in use and the enjoyment of them, but exchange value and its augmentation that spur him into action. Fanatically bent on making the value expand itself, he ruthlessly forces the human race to produce for production's sake. He thus forces the development of the productive powers of society, and creates those material conditions which alone can form the real basis of a higher form of society, a society in which the full and free development of every individual forms the ruling principle. Only as personified capital is the capitalist respectable. As such, he shares with the miser the passion for wealth as wealth. But that which in the miser is a mere idiosyncrasy is, in the capitalist, the effect of the social mechanism of which he is but one of the wheels. Moreover, the development of capitalist production makes it constantly necessary to keep increasing the amount of capital laid out in a given industrial undertaking, and competition makes the eminent laws of capitalist production to be felt by each individual capitalist as external coercive laws. It compels him to keep constantly extending his capital in order to preserve it, but extend it he cannot, except by means of progressive accumulation. So far, therefore, as his actions are a mere function of capital, endowed as capital is in his person with consciousness and a will, his own private consumption is a robbery perpetrated on accumulation, just as in bookkeeping by double entry, the private expenditure of the capitalist is placed on the debtor side of his account against his capital. To accumulate is to conquer the world of social wealth, to increase the mass of human beings exploited by him, and thus to extend both the direct and the indirect sway of the capitalist. Footnote. Taking the usurer, that old-fashioned but ever-renewed specimen of the capitalist, for his text, Luther shows, very aptly, that the love of power is an element in the desire to get rich. The heathen were able, by the light of reason, to conclude that a usurer is a double-dyed thief and murderer. We Christians, however, hold them in such honour that we fairly worship them for the sake of their money. Whoever eats up, robs and steals the nourishment of another, that man commits as great a murder, so far as in him lies, as he who starves a man or utterly undoes him. Such does a usurer, and sits the while safe on his stool, when he ought rather to be hanging on the gallows, and be eaten by as many ravens as he has stolen guilders. If only there were so much flesh on him that so many ravens could stick their beaks in and share it. Meanwhile, we hang the small thieves. Little thieves are put in the stocks, great thieves go flaunting in gold and silk. Therefore is there, on this earth, no greater enemy of man, after the devil, than a gripe money, and usurer, for he wants to be God over all men. Turks, soldiers, and tyrants are also bad men, yet must they let the people live and confess that they are bad, and enemies, and do, nay must, now and then show pity to some. But a usurer and money glutton, such a one would have the whole world perish of hunger and thirst, misery and want, so far as in him lies, so that he may have all to himself, and every one may receive from him as from a god, and be his serf for ever. To wear fine cloaks, golden chains, rings, to wipe his mouth, to be deemed and taken for a worthy, pious man. Usury is a great monster, like a werewolf, who lays waste all, more than any Carcass, Geryon, or Antus, and yet decks himself out, and would be thought pious, so that people may not see where the oxen have gone that he drags backwards into his den. But Hercules shall hear the cry of the oxen and of his prisoners, and shall seek Carcass even in cliffs and among rocks, and shall set the oxen loose again from the villain. For Carcass means the villain that is a pious usurer, and steals, robs, eats everything, and will not own that he has done it, and thinks no one will find him out, because the oxen, drawn backwards into his den, make it seem, from their footprints, that they have been let out. So the usurer would deceive the world as though he were of use, and gave the world oxen, which he, however, rends and eats all alone. And since we break on the wheel and behead highwaymen, murderers, and housebreakers, how much more ought we to break on the wheel and kill, hunt down, curse, and behead all usurers? Martin Luther. End of footnote. But original sin is at work everywhere. As capitalist production, accumulation, and wealth become developed, the capitalist ceases to be the mere incarnation of capital. He has a fellow feeling for his own Adam, and his education gradually enables him to smile at the rage for asceticism as a mere prejudice of the old-fashioned miser. While the capitalist of the classical type brands individual consumption as a sin against his function, and as abstinence from accumulating, the modernized capitalist is capable of looking upon accumulation as abstinence from pleasure. Two souls, alas, do dwell within his breast. The one is ever parting from the other. Footnote. See Goethe's Faust. End of footnote. At the historical dawn of capitalist production, and every capitalist upstart has personally to go through this historical stage, avarice and desire to get rich are the ruling passions. But the progress of capitalist production not only creates a world of delights, it lays open, in speculation and the credit system, a thousand sources of sudden enrichment. When a certain stage of development has been reached, a conventional degree of prodigality, which is also an exhibition of wealth, and consequently a source of credit, becomes a business necessity to the unfortunate capitalist. Luxury enters into capital's expenses of representation. Moreover, the capitalist gets rich, not like the miser, in proportion to his personal labour and restricted consumption, but at the same rate as he squeezes out the labour power of others, and enforces on the labourer abstinence from all life's enjoyments. Although, therefore, the prodigality of the capitalist never possesses the bona fide character of the open-handed feudal lord's prodigality, but, on the contrary, has always lurking behind it the most sordid avarice and the most anxious calculation, yet his expenditure grows with his accumulation, without the one necessarily restricting the other. But along with this growth, there is at the same time developed in his breast a Faustian conflict between the passion for accumulation and the desire for enjoyment. Dr. Aikin says in a work published in 1795, "The trade of Manchester may be divided into four periods. First, when manufacturers were obliged to work hard for their livelihood. They enriched themselves chiefly by robbing the parents, whose children were bound as apprentices to them. The parents paid a high premium, while the apprentices were starved. On the other hand, the average profits were low, and to accumulate, extreme parsimony was requisite. They lived like misers and were far from consuming even the interest on their capital. The second period, when they had begun to acquire little fortunes, but worked as hard as before. For direct exploitation of labour costs labour, as every slave driver knows, and lived in as plain a manner as before. The third, when luxury began, and the trade was pushed by sending out riders for orders into every market town in the kingdom. It is probable that few or no capitals of £3,000 to £4,000 acquired by trade existed here before 1690. However, about that time, or a little later, the traders had got money beforehand, and began to build modern brick houses instead of those of wooden plaster. Even in the early part of the 18th century, a Manchester manufacturer who placed a pint of foreign wine before his guests exposed himself to the remarks and head-shakings of all his neighbours. Before the rise of machinery, a manufacturer's evening expenditure at the public house where they all met never exceeded sixpence for a glass of punch and a penny for a screw of tobacco. It was not till 1758, and this marks an epoch, that a person actually engaged in business was seen with an equipage of his own. The fourth period, the last 30 years of the 18th century, is that in which expense and luxury have made great progress, and was supported by a trade extended by means of riders and factors through every part of Europe. Footnote. Dr. Aikin, Description of the Country from 30 to 40 Miles Round Manchester, 1795. End of footnote. What would the good Dr. Aikin say if he could rise from his grave and see the Manchester of today? Accumulate, accumulate. That is Moses and the prophets. Industry furnishes the material which saving accumulates. Footnote. A. Smith. End of footnote. Therefore, save, save. That is, reconvert the greatest possible portion of surplus value or surplus product into capital. Accumulation for accumulation's sake. Production for production's sake. By this formula, classical economy expressed the historical mission of the bourgeoisie, and did not for a single instant deceive itself over the birth throes of wealth. Footnote. Even J.B. Say says, "The savings of the rich are made at the expense of the poor." End of footnote. But what avails lamentation in the face of historical necessity? If, to classical economy, the proletarian is but a machine for the production of surplus value, on the other hand, the capitalist is in its eyes only a machine for the conversion of this surplus value into additional capital. Political economy takes the historical function of the capitalist in bitter earnest. In order to charm out of his bosom the awful conflict between the desire for enjoyment and the chase after riches, Malthus, about the year 1820, advocated a division of labour, which assigns to the capitalist actually engaged in production the business of accumulating, and to the other sharers in surplus value, to the landlords, the placemen, the beneficed clergy, etc., the business of spending. It is of the highest importance, he says, to keep separate the passion for expenditure and the passion for accumulation. The capitalists, having long been good livers and men of the world, uttered loud cries. "What?" exclaimed one of their spokesmen, a disciple of Ricardo. "Mr. Malthus preaches high rents, heavy taxes, etc., so that the pressure of the spur may constantly be kept on the industrious by unproductive consumers." By all means, production, production on a constantly increasing scale runs the shibboleth. But production will, by such a process, be far more curbed in than spurred on. Nor is it quite fair thus to maintain in idleness a number of persons, only to pinch others, who are likely from their characters, if you can force them to work with success. Footnote. An inquiry into those principles respecting the nature of demand, etc. End of footnote. Unfair as he finds it to spur on the industrial capitalist by depriving his bread of its butter, yet he thinks it necessary to reduce the labourer's wages to a minimum, to keep him industrious. Nor does he for a moment conceal the fact that the appropriation of unpaid labour is the secret of surplus value. Increased demand on the part of the labourers means nothing more than their willingness to take less of their own product for themselves and leave a greater part of it to their employers. And if it be said that this begets glut by lessening consumption on the part of the labourers, I can only reply that glut is synonymous with large profits. The learned disputation, how the booty pumped out of the labourer may be divided with most advantage to accumulation, between the industrial capitalist and the rich idler was hushed in the face of the Revolution of July. Shortly afterwards, the town proletariat at Lyon sounded the tocsin of revolution, and the country proletariat in England began to set fire to farmyards and corn stacks. On this side of the Channel, Owenism began to spread. On the other side, St. Simonism and Fourierism. The hour of vulgar economy had struck. Exactly a year before Nassau W. Sr. discovered at Manchester that the profit, including interest, of capital is the product of the last hour of the 12, he had announced to the world another discovery. "I substitute," he proudly says, "for the word capital, considered as an instrument of production, the word abstinence." An unparalleled sample, this, of the discoveries of vulgar economy. It substitutes for an economic category a sycophantic phrase. Voilà tout. That's all. When the savage, says Senior, makes bows, he exercises an industry, but he does not practice abstinence. Footnote. Senior. Principes fondamentaux de l'économie politique. Paris, 1836. This was rather too much for the adherents of the old classical school. Mr. Senior has substituted for it the expression labour and profit, the expression labour and abstinence. He who converts his revenue abstains from the enjoyment which its expenditure would afford him. It is not the capital, but the use of the capital productively, which is the cause of profits. John Kazanov. John St. Mill, on the contrary, accepts on the one hand Ricardo's theory of profit, and annexes, on the other hand, Senior's remuneration of abstinence. He is as much at home in absurd contradictions as he feels at sea in the Hegelian contradiction, the source of all dialectic. It has never occurred to the vulgar economist to make the simple reflection that every human action may be viewed as abstinence from its opposite. Eating is abstinence from fasting, walking, abstinence from standing still, working, abstinence from idling, idling, abstinence from working, etc. These gentlemen would do well to ponder once in a while over Spinoza's Determinatio est negatio. End of footnote. This explains how and why, in the earlier states of society, the implements of labour were fabricated without abstinence on the part of the capitalist. The more society progresses, says Senior, the more abstinence is demanded, namely, from those who ply the industry of appropriating the fruits of others' industry. All the conditions for carrying on the labour process are suddenly converted into so many acts of abstinence on the part of the capitalist. If the corn is not all eaten, but part of it also sown, abstinence of the capitalist. If the wine gets time to mature, abstinence of the capitalist. Footnote. No one will sow his wheat, for instance, and allow it to remain a 12-month in the ground, or leave his wine in a cellar for years, instead of consuming these things or their equivalent at once, unless he expects to acquire additional value, etc. Scrope, Political Economy, edited by A. Potter, New York, 1841, end of footnote. The capitalist robs his own self whenever he lends the instruments of production to the labourer, that is, whenever by incorporating labour power with them, he uses them to extract surplus value out of that labour power instead of eating them up, steam engines, cotton, railways, manure, horses and all, or as the vulgar economist childishly puts it, instead of dissipating their value in luxuries and other articles of consumption. Footnote. The deprivation the capitalist imposes on himself by lending, this euphemism used for the purpose of identifying, according to the approved method of vulgar economy, the labourer who is exploited with the industrial capitalist who exploits and to whom other capitalists lend money, his instruments of production to the worker, instead of devoting their value to his own consumption, by transforming them into objects of utility or pleasure. G. de Molinari, end of footnote. How the capitalists, as a class, are to perform that feat is a secret that vulgar economy has hitherto obstinately refused to divulge. Enough that the world still jogs on, solely through the self-chastisement of this modern penitent of Vishnu, the capitalist. Not only accumulation, but the simple conservation of a capital requires a constant effort to resist the temptation of consuming it. Courcelle Sonneuil. The simple dictates of humanity therefore plainly enjoin the release of the capitalist from this martyrdom and temptation, in the same way that the Georgian slave owner was lately delivered, by the abolition of slavery, from the painful dilemma whether to squander the surplus product lashed out of his negroes entirely in champagne, or whether to reconvert a part of it into more negroes and more land. In economic forms of society of the most different kinds, there occurs not only simple reproduction, but, in varying degrees, reproduction on a progressively increasing scale. By degrees, more is produced and more consumed, and consequently more products have to be converted into means of production. This process, however, does not present itself as accumulation of capital, nor as the function of a capitalist, so long as the labourer's means of production, and with them his product and means of subsistence, do not confront him in the shape of capital. Footnote. The particular classes of income which yield the most abundantly to the progress of national capital change at different stages of their progress, and are therefore entirely different in nations occupying different positions in that progress. Profits, unimportant source of accumulation, compared with wages and rents, in the earlier stages of society. When a considerable advance in the powers of national industry has actually taken place, profits rise into comparative importance as a source of accumulation. Richard Jones, textbook, etc. End of footnote. Richard Jones, who died a few years ago, and was the successor of Malthus in the chair of political economy at Haileybury College, discusses this point well in the light of two important facts. Since the great mass of the Hindu population are peasants cultivating their land themselves, their products, their instruments of labour, and means of subsistence never take, quote, the shape of a fund saved from revenue, which fund has therefore gone through a previous process of accumulation. End of quote. On the other hand, the non-agricultural labourers in those provinces where the English rule has least disturbed the old system are directly employed by the magnates, to whom a portion of the agricultural surplus product is rendered in the shape of tribute or rent. One portion of this product is consumed by the magnates in kind, another is converted for their use by the labourers into articles of luxury and such like things, while the rest forms the wages of the labourers, who own their implements of labour. Here, production and reproduction on a progressively increasing scale go on their way without any intervention from that queer saint, that knight of the woeful countenance, the capitalist abstainer. Section 4. Circumstances that, independently of the proportional division of surplus value into capital and revenue, determine the amount of accumulation. Degree of exploitation of labour power. Productivity of labour. growing difference in amount between capital employed and capital consumed. Magnitude of capital advanced. The proportion in which surplus value breaks up into capital and revenue being given, the magnitude of the capital accumulated clearly depends on the absolute magnitude of the surplus value. Suppose that 80% were capitalized and 20% eaten up. The accumulated capital will be £2,400 or £200, according as the total surplus value has amounted to £3,000 or £500. Hence, all the circumstances that determine the mass of surplus value operate to determine the magnitude of the accumulation. We sum them up once again, but only in so far as they afford new points of view in regard to accumulation. It will be remembered that the rate of surplus value depends, in the first place, on the degree of exploitation of labour power. Political economy values this fact so highly that it occasionally identifies the acceleration of accumulation due to increased productiveness of labour with its acceleration due to increased exploitation of the labourer. Footnote. Ricardo says, in different stages of society, the accumulation of capital or of the means of employing, that is, exploiting, labour, is more or less rapid, and must in all cases depend on the productive powers of labour. The productive powers of labour are generally greatest where there is an abundance of fertile land. If in the first sentence, the productive powers of labour mean the smallness of that aliquot part of any produce that goes to those whose manual labour produced it, the second sentence is nearly identical, because the remaining aliquot part is the fund whence capital can, if the owner pleases, be accumulated. But then this does not generally happen, where there is most fertile land. Observations on certain verbal disputes, etc. End of footnote. In the chapters on the production of surplus value, it was constantly presupposed that wages are at least equal to the value of labour power. Forcible reduction of wages below this value plays, however, in practice, too important a part for us not to pause upon it for a moment. It in fact transforms, within certain limits, the labourer's necessary consumption fund into a fund for the accumulation of capital. Wages, says John Stuart Mill, have no productive power. They are the price of a productive power. Wages do not contribute, along with labour, to the production of commodities no more than the price of tools contributes along with the tools themselves. If labour could be had without purchase, wages might be dispensed with. Footnote. John Stuart Mill, Essays on Some Unsettled Questions of Political Economy, London, 1844. End of footnote. But if the labourers could live on air, they could not be bought at any price. The zero of their cost is therefore a limit, in a mathematical sense, always beyond reach, although we can always approximate more and more nearly to it. The constant tendency of capital is to force the cost of labour back towards this zero. A writer of the 18th century, often quoted already, the author of the Essay on Trade and Commerce, only betrays the innermost secret soul of English capitalism when he declares the historic mission of England to be the forcing down of English wages to the level of the French and the Dutch. Footnote. An Essay on Trade and Commerce, London, 1770. The Times of December 1866 and January 1867, in like manner, published certain outpourings of the heart of the English mine owner, in which the happy lot of the Belgian miners was pictured, who asked and received no more than was strictly necessary for them to live for their masters. The Belgian labourers have to suffer much, but to figure in the Times as model labourers In the beginning of February 1867 came the answer, "Strike of the Belgian miners at Marchienne, put down by powder and lead." End of footnote. With other things, he says, naively, "But if our poor," technical term for labourers, "will live luxuriously, then labour must, of course, be dear. When it is considered what luxuries the manufacturing populace consume, such as brandy, gin, tea, sugar, foreign fruit, strong beer, printed linens, snuff, tobacco, etc." He quotes the work of a Northamptonshire manufacturer who, with eyes squinting heavenward, moans, "Labour is one-third cheaper in France than in England, for their poor work hard and fare hard as to their food and clothing. Their chief diet is bread, fruit, herbs, roots, and dried fish, for they very seldom eat flesh. And when wheat is dear, they eat very little bread." Footnote. The Northamptonshire manufacturer commits a pious fraud, pardonable in one whose heart is so full. He nominally compares the life of the English and French manufacturing labourer, but in the words just quoted, he is painting, as he himself confesses in his confused way, the French agricultural labourers. End of footnote. To which may be added, our essayist goes on, that their drink is either water or other small liquors, so they spend very little money. These things are very difficult to be brought about, but they are not impracticable, since they have been effected both in France and in Holland. Footnote. Note in the third German edition. Today, thanks to the competition on the world market established since then, we have advanced much further. If China, says Mr. Stapleton, MP, to his constituents, should become a great manufacturing country, I do not see how the manufacturing population of Europe could sustain the contest without descending to the level of their competitors. Times, September 3, 1873. The wished-for goal of English capital is no longer continental wages, but Chinese. End of footnote. 20 years later, an American humbug, the baronized Yankee Benjamin Thompson, alias Count Rumford, followed the same line of philanthropy to the great satisfaction of God and man. His Essays are a cookery book with recipes of all kinds for replacing, by some succedaneum, the ordinary dear food of the labourer. The following is a particularly successful recipe of this wonderful philosopher. 5 pounds of barley meal, 7 pence halfpenny, 5 pounds of Indian corn, 6 pence farthing, 3 pence worth of red herring, 1 penny worth of salt, 1 penny worth of vinegar, 2 pence worth of pepper and sweet herbs, in all 20 pence and 3/4. Make a soup for 64 men, and at the medium price of barley and of Indian corn, this soup may be provided at 1 farthing, the portion of 20 ounces. Footnote. Benjamin Thompson, Essays, Political, Economical, and Philosophical, etc., 1796-1802. In his The State of the Poor, or An History of the Labouring Classes in England, etc., Sir F. M. Eden strongly recommends the Rumfordian beggar soup to workhouse overseers, and reproachfully warns the English labourers that many poor people, particularly in Scotland, live, and that very comfortably, for months together, upon oatmeal and barley meal mixed with only water and salt. The same sort of hints in the 19th century. The most wholesome mixtures of flour having been refused by the English agricultural labourer, in Scotland, where education is better, this prejudice is, probably, unknown. Charles H. Parry, M.D., The Question of the Necessity of the Existing Corn Laws Considered, London, 1816. This same Parry, however, complains that the English labourer is now, 1815, in a much worse condition than in Eden's time, 1797. End of footnote. With the advance of capitalistic production, The adulteration of food rendered Thompson's ideal superfluous. Footnote. From the reports of the last Parliamentary Commission on Adulteration of Means of Subsistence, it will be seen that the adulteration even of medicines is the rule, not the exception, in England. For example, the examination of 34 specimens of opium, purchased of as many different chemists in London, showed that 31 were adulterated with poppy heads, wheat flour, gum, clay, sand, etc. Several did not contain an atom of morphia. End of footnote. At the end of the 18th, and during the first 10 years of the 19th century, the English farmers and landlords enforced the absolute minimum of wage by paying the agricultural labourers less than the minimum in the form of wages and the remainder in the shape of parochial relief. An example of the waggish way in which the English Dogberries acted in their legal fixing of a wages tariff. "The squires of Norfolk had dined," says Mr. Burke, "when they fixed the rate of wages. The squires of Berks evidently thought the labourers ought not to do so when they fixed the rates of wages at Speenhamland, 1795. There they decide that income, weekly, should be 3 shillings for a man. When the gallon or half-peck loaf of 8 pounds 11 ounces is at 1 shilling, and increase regularly till bread is 1 and 5 pence. When it is above that sum, decrease regularly till it be at 2 shillings, and then his food should be 1/5 less." Footnote. G.B. Newnham, Barrister at Law, A Review of the Evidence Before the Committee of the Two Houses of Parliament on the Corn Laws, London, 1815. End of footnote. Before the Committee of Inquiry of the House of Lords, 1814, a certain A. Bennett, a large farmer, magistrate, poor law guardian, and wage regulator, was asked, "Has any proportion of the value of daily labour been made up to the labourers out of the poor's rate?" Answer, "Yes, it has. The weekly income of every family is made up to the gallon loaf, 8 pounds 11 ounces, and 3 pence per head. The gallon loaf per week is what we suppose sufficient for the maintenance of every person in the family for the week, and the 3 pence is for clothes. And if the parish think proper to find clothes, the 3 pence is deducted. This practice goes through all the western part of Wiltshire, and, I believe, throughout the country. For years," exclaims a bourgeois author of that time, "the farmers have degraded a respectable class of their countrymen by forcing them to have recourse to the workhouse. The farmer, while increasing his own gains, has prevented any accumulation on the part of his labouring dependents." Footnote. C.H. Parry. "The landlords, on their side, not only indemnified themselves for the anti-Jacobin war, which they waged in the name of England, but enriched themselves enormously. Their rents doubled, trebled, quadrupled, and in one instance increased sixfold in 18 years. End of footnote. The part played in our days by the direct robbery from the labourer's necessary consumption fund in the formation of surplus value, and therefore of the accumulation fund of capital, the so-called domestic industry has served to show. Chapter 15, Section 8. Further facts on this subject will be given later. Although in all branches of industry, that part of the constant capital consisting of instruments of labour must be sufficient for a certain number of labourers, determined by the magnitude of the undertaking, it by no means always necessarily increases in the same proportion as the quantity of labour employed. In a factory, suppose that 100 labourers working 8 hours a day yield 800 working hours. If the capitalist wishes to raise this sum by one half, he can employ 50 more workers. But then he must also advance more capital, not merely for wages, but for instruments of labour. But he might also let the 100 labourers work 12 hours instead of 8, and then the instruments of labour all ready to hand would be enough. These would then simply be more rapidly consumed. Thus, additional labour, begotten of the greater tension of labour power, can augment surplus product and surplus value, that is, the subject matter of accumulation, without corresponding augmentation in the constant part of capital. In the extractive industries, mines, etc., the raw materials form no part of the capital advanced. The subject of labour is in this case not a product of previous labour, but is furnished by nature, gratis, as in the case of metals, minerals, coal, stone, etc. In these cases, the constant capital consists almost exclusively of instruments of labour, which can very well absorb an increased quantity of labour. Day and night shifts of labourers, for example. All other things being equal, the mass and value of the product will rise in direct proportion to the labour expended. As on the first day of production, the original produce formers, now turned into the creators of the material elements of capital, man and nature, still work together. Thanks to the elasticity of labour power, the domain of accumulation has extended without any previous enlargement of constant capital. In agriculture, the land under cultivation cannot be increased without the advance of more seed and manure. But this advance once made, the purely mechanical working of the soil itself, produces a marvellous effect on the amount of the product. A greater quantity of labour, done by the same number of labourers as before, thus increases the fertility without requiring any new advance in the instruments of labour. It is once again the direct action of man on nature, which becomes an immediate source of greater accumulation, without the intervention of any new capital. Finally, in what is called manufacturing industry, every additional expenditure of labour presupposes a corresponding additional expenditure of raw materials, but not necessarily of instruments of labour. And as extractive industry and agriculture supply manufacturing industry with its raw materials and those of its instruments of labour, the additional product the former have created without additional advance of capital tells also in favour of the latter. General result: by incorporating with itself the two primary creators of wealth, labour power and the land, capital acquires a power of expansion that permits it to augment the elements of its accumulation beyond the limits apparently fixed by its own magnitude, or by the value and the mass of the means of production already produced, in which it has its being. Another important factor in the accumulation of capital is the degree of productivity of social labour. With the productive power of labour increases the mass of the products, in which a certain value, and therefore a surplus value of a given magnitude, is embodied. The rate of surplus value remaining the same, or even falling, so long as it only falls more slowly than the productive power of labour rises, the mass of the surplus product increases. The division of this product into revenue and additional capital remaining the same, the consumption of the capitalist may, therefore, increase without any decrease in the fund of accumulation. The relative magnitude of the accumulation fund may even increase at the expense of the consumption fund, whilst the cheapening of commodities places at the disposal of the capitalist as many means of enjoyment as formerly, or even more than formerly. But hand in hand with the increasing productivity of labour goes, as we have seen, the cheapening of the labourer, therefore a higher rate of surplus value, even when the real wages are rising. The latter never rise proportionally to the productive power of labour. The same value in variable capital therefore sets in movement more labour power and therefore more labour. The same value in constant capital is embodied in more means of production, that is, in more instruments of labour, materials of labour, and auxiliary materials. It therefore also supplies more elements for the production both of use value and of value, and with these more absorbers of labour. The value of the additional capital, therefore, remaining the same or even diminishing, accelerated accumulation still takes place. Not only does the scale of reproduction materially extend, but the production of surplus value increases more rapidly than the value of the additional capital. The development of the productive power of labour reacts also on the original capital already engaged in the process of production. A part of the functioning constant capital consists of instruments of labour, such as machinery, etc., which are not consumed, and therefore not reproduced or replaced by new ones of the same kind, until after long periods of time. But every year, a part of these instruments of labour perishes or reaches the limit of its productive function. It reaches, therefore, in that year, the time for its periodical reproduction, for its replacement by new ones of the same kind. If the productiveness of labour has, during the using up of these instruments of labour, increased, and it develops continually with the uninterrupted advance of science and technology, more efficient and, considering their increased efficiency, cheaper machines, tools, apparatus, etc., replace the old. The old capital is reproduced in a more productive form, apart from the constant detail improvements in the instruments of labour already in use. The other part of the constant capital, raw material and auxiliary substances, is constantly reproduced in less than a year, those produced by agriculture, for the most part, annually. Every introduction of improved methods, therefore, works almost simultaneously on the new capital, on that already in action. Every advance in chemistry not only multiplies the number of useful materials and the useful applications of those already known, thus extending with the growth of capital its sphere of investment, it teaches at the same time how to throw the excrements of the processes of production and consumption back again into the circle of the process of reproduction, and thus, without any previous outlay of capital, creates new matter for capital. Like the increased exploitation of natural wealth by the mere increase in the tension of labour power, science and technology give capital a power of expansion independent of the given magnitude of the capital actually functioning. They react at the same time on that part of the original capital which has entered upon its stage of renewal. This, in passing into its new shape, incorporates gratis the social advance made while its old shape was being used up. Of course, this development of productive power is accompanied by a partial depreciation of functioning capital. So far as this depreciation makes itself acutely felt in competition, the burden falls on the labourer, in the increased exploitation of whom the capitalist looks for his indemnification. Labour transmits to its product the value of the means of production consumed by it. On the other hand, the value and mass of the means of production set in motion by a given quantity of labour increase as the labour becomes more productive. Though the same quantity of labour adds always to its products only the same sum of new value, still the old capital value, transmitted by the labour to the products, increases with the growing productivity of labour. An English and a Chinese spinner, for example, may work the same number of hours with the same intensity. Then they will both in a week create equal values. But in spite of this equality, an immense difference will obtain between the value of the week's product of the Englishman, who works with a mighty automaton, and that of the Chinaman, who has but a spinning wheel. In the same time as the Chinaman spins 1 pound of cotton, the Englishman spins several hundreds of pounds. A sum many hundred times as great of old values swells the value of his product, in which those reappear in a new, useful form, and can thus function anew as capital. In 1782, as Frederick Engels teaches us, all the wool crop in England of the three preceding years lay untouched for want of labourers, and so it must have lain if newly invented machinery had not come to its aid and spun it. Footnote. Friedrich Engels, Lage der arbeitenden Klasse in England. End of footnote. Labour embodied in the form of machinery, of course, did not directly force into life a single man, but it made it possible for a smaller number of labourers, with the addition of relatively less living labour, not only to consume the wool productively and put into it new value, but to preserve in the form of yarn, etc., its old value. At the same time, it caused and stimulated increased reproduction of wool. It is the natural property of living labour to transmit old value whilst it creates new. Hence, with the increase in efficacy, extent, and value of its means of production,